Hello and welcome to another episode of the Rethink Energy Podcast. I'm your host for today yet again, our automotive and battery analyst, Connor Watts. I'm joined again by our analyst and editor, Bogdan Avramov.
Hello, everybody.
And we're joined yet again by our solar analyst, Andreas Fontenot.
Good morning.
In this week's episode, we're going to be talking about yet another interview with perovskite company Tandem PV, as Andreas gets yet more information out of this particular upstart in the industry. Then we're going to talk about how the EU's electric vehicle probe investigators have now landed in China to determine whether or not Chinese companies have been unduly supported by the Chinese state. And finally, we're going to be talking about how Frontline, a Norwegian tank company, is kind of taking notice of industry trends in maritime decarbonization, but is also very much getting it wrong. So first of all, Andreas, what did you learn from Tandem PV this time?
So I spoke to Scott Wharton, the CEO, for the second time. The first time I spoke to him was a little bit unfortunate because he'd only just arrived as CEO, so he didn't necessarily really know exactly what he was talking about in some cases.
When was this?
That was 5 months ago. And he was brought in with the goal of commercializing something. So this is a sort of 1,200, 1,400 word piece, kind of long and just tries to cover everything that he said, sort of situation report on what might be.
What are the highlights?
Yeah, so the highlights. One of the interesting things for me was just hearing, I mean, I guess I already knew this. I guess it's kind of obvious when it's pointed out. But one of the interesting things was having him point out, oh, yeah, we've got one module in tests that's the best degradation. It's got the best lifespan. We've got another that we managed to push up to 300 square centimeter size. And we've got another that's 26% efficiency, also on a fairly decent size, 100 square centimeters. Now, of course, when you think about it, that makes total sense because the whole deal with perovskite research is that a perovskite is a structure and the exact elements that you put into the molecule that is a perovskite, I think that's the correct way to put it, are changeable. So there's literally something like 10 to the power of 72, don't quote me on that, some ridiculous number of possible combinations. There's also many, many different manufacturing processes. So there are just so many different options that you can explore. And so probably every single perovskite company has in their R&D system the biggest module that they've managed to make, the most efficient, and the most durable. Just interesting to have that pointed out explicitly. Now, there's a fair number of numbers in this article, like the 26% and the 100 square centimeters that I've already stated, and they do sound quite impressive. So the deal with perovskite efficiency ratings is that the ones on 1 square centimeter are kind of trivial. A single researcher in a university can do that, but when you scale it up, you start losing efficiency. So then, of course, to commercialize, you also need to get it to probably a 25-year lifespan. So it's actually a balance of these three different things. These numbers are always in danger of being misleading at the best of times because really you need the combination of all three. And in Tandem PV's case, they haven't yet had these new numbers certified.
I was going to ask. So yeah. When it comes to Tandem PV's commercialization process, you say that the new CEO has been brought in to kind of get a product out into the market and have the company making the revenue effectively.
Yeah.
This still very much sounds like it's in a bit of an R&D phase and it hasn't quite landed on what exactly it wants to sell. When you have multiple prototypes of different focus points, as it were, that's almost that.
Oh, well, they are only pursuing one. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, so that when it comes to when you produce prototypes for optimizing for different capabilities, that tends to be a research task that's, I wouldn't say early on, but
it's not
continuous effort, obviously.
These are three different things. So they try to, you know, so intellectually, you can only, in some sense, you can only focus on one each, and you would naturally try and have all three. You would naturally end up developing the three separately and then trying to combine them, which is what he says they're doing. So they do know what they're trying to produce as the end goal. They're not pursuing multiple routes to commercialization. And that's another interesting thing about this article. The other surprising thing is they're actually looking for the utility scale market. And I think that's because the US is mostly utility scale. The rooftop segment is very much suffering, so it can't afford to conduct experiments. So he's ended up with the people expressing interest being utility scale developers.
There's a very good point in it. in that the IRA subsidies have been designed around silicon-based manufacturing costs, correct?
Yes, which is very funny when you start looking at, and because it's to every single segment, like wafer, polysilicon, cell, module, like there are some parts where, I mean, what's the wafer cost? There isn't really a wafer cost for, as far as I understand, not comparable to the silicon Joukowsky process. So I believe that for some processes, a non-silicon photovoltaic, like perovskites, and perhaps also like First Solar, will be getting paid. I also, you know, and Scott Wharton says he thinks that these subsidies add up to about $175 per kilowatt. Now, the Chinese are actually selling modules for $135 per kilowatt. So the subsidy for making it in America is now bigger than the cost of the module in China, which is not even that unreasonable because that just reflects how wildly different the production costs are. Like it's a factor of two, probably. I don't think they've actually...
You can't exactly directly translate the Chinese production costs to American. You see the exact same thing in the battery industry of China's production costs are maybe like 75% of that of what it would be in the West at economies of scale. So it's more like 40 to 50% higher if you have a smaller factory, as it were.
So really, the overall tone of this article is that Mr. Wharton was extremely confident. I think he said that dozens of companies have said, actually, these results you're presenting to us are better than anyone else's when you look at the combination across the three factors that I mentioned of size, durability, and efficiency. And Mr. Wharton says that really surprised him because he thought he was just showing up to a company that doesn't have the long-established reputation of, for example, Oxford PV. So he was expecting to be further behind them rather than, he says, on par. Now, I mean, it's just him saying this. He's just saying, oh, yeah, we're confident. Oh, yeah, we're working towards commercialization. We don't have a certification yet, but we will in 6 months. So, of course, he would say that. So we'll just have to wait and see, won't we? I guess he was a bit franker on some of this than some other people have been, so...
Yeah, Wharton does seem to be very curt and very forward about how his company's doing, in particular with regards to the research phase, which a lot of companies do not want to talk about.
Yeah, you think he's frank. I get that impression too.
Well, just the level of information you can get out of. In the context of talking to startups, particularly in a relatively early phase of commercial development, most companies like to keep their information close to their chest unless they go through a funding round. And even then, they only really cherry-pick certain results. So,
but regardless, Andreas, in the context of perovskites, yeah, would you say the Tandem PV is one of the market leaders in terms of Western manufacturers?
Well, I can just quote what he said, and which is he wants to be in the top six, and I think that's pretty reasonable for the West because they're all in the same boat of having a pilot line that's not running at full capacity, anything like that. And by the way, Tandem PV did just raise the money for a 150 megawatt pilot line. So that would put it in like the top 10, I guess, because there's now 10 companies that have done that worldwide. That's including about four in China. So, I mean, it's a company that might be first off the block. Another thing to mention is that it does four terminal. So it actually prints the perovskite onto the glass that is then used in the assembly of a standard silicon module. And I believe that is simpler than integrating it at the cell level. Effectively, you end up with two separate modules. And I believe that is simpler apart from anything else because you don't have to do current matching. Now, when I raised this with the CTO of Oxford PV, and I said, well, isn't four terminals simpler? And isn't that actually better when you're looking at a product that is difficult to commercialize for technical reasons? Isn't it better to go for the sort of simpler option? And he said, no, because Oxford PV is two terminal. They integrate it at the cell level. He said, no, oh, there's no problem around current matching. We've solved that. So, you know, they're basically disagreeing with each other. And fortunately, my latest perovskite report puts mass adoption forward into 2026. So hopefully I'm not falsified. And hopefully by then we actually have some hard data to look at beyond just a 1 megawatt installation in Inner Mongolia, which is what we have now.
Just a point with regards to whether or not they're top 6, said that that's what they're aiming for. When you're talking about the amount of Chinese companies functioning as well, they're starting in the US market, where Chinese companies are going to seriously struggle to operate, basically regardless of the results of any geopolitical changes. So we're really only talking about Western companies here, and that's where they need to improve and where they need to lead if they want to be succeeding in properly commercializing this product. So I don't think taking Chinese companies into account is particularly important when we're looking at the US market and the development of US perovskites.
Yeah, and even with Europe, so I wrote another article about European manufacturing, which is, for the past few years I've done this thing of saying, oh yeah, the Europeans are talking about protecting their solar manufacturing, but they're still not actually doing it. And what's happening now is that it's gone on for so many years of talking about it but not doing it, that the latest comment from the European Solar Manufacturing Council is now saying, they've published a press release yesterday saying, and it's titled A Plea for Survival, and that's not an exaggeration at all, and the language is apocalyptic. And so that is just a disaster because it's just not protected. But I do think perovskites could be a way to survive because it just obviates some of China's advantage, which is cheaper energy, basically electricity and temperature. Now, so with silicon, you've got temperatures of 1,100 degrees and 1,400 degrees in two different processes. With tandem PVs perovskites, and probably a lot of other perovskites as well, the maximum temperature is like, well, he told me 150 degrees. And in general, I don't believe it goes above 300. So that just means the electricity cost is much cheaper. And electricity features at really every stage of manufacturing for modules. So it is a really big fraction. So if you reduce that, you've got something that can be competitive. I just went on a bit of a tangent there, but hopefully right. I answered your question.
It is very interesting with regards to the electricity costs and kind of offsetting that. But just moving on, as we were talking about protecting European manufacturing, the European Union has sent over its boffins to China, specifically to investigate BYD, Geely, and SAIC, and their production facilities, and whether or not the answers to the questionnaires that they sent out earlier last year were indeed true. Now, this can be looked at from a few different angles, and there's different impacts on different stakeholders. It's a very, very important thing for Europe's automotive manufacturing. Now, this EV probe seemingly came a bit out of nowhere, as really it's just a testament to the strength of the automotive lobby in Europe, which, speaking of, Northvolt just received about $1 billion in subsidies from Germany to keep its battery manufacturing plant there rather than running off to the US. And so Europe is very much trying to keep its manufacturing in-house and to keep it competitive. Now, that's what the EV probe is focusing on doing, and they're effectively looking for any reason they can to eliminate Chinese supplies from entering the European market. Now, this would be incredibly good for consumers because, and by that I mean Chinese Chinese automobiles being sold in Europe with no punitive tariffs because they are the most cost efficient for reasons that are measurable, which Andreas mentioned before with regards to solar, in that electricity costs are lower, labor costs are lower, they've been doing it for longer, so they have the processes figured out, and they're making vehicles that are simply superior than the Western alternatives. There's no, on a design level and on a product level, there isn't really too much arguing that the best Chinese vehicles right now for certain price points are better than the best Western vehicles as of right now. I mean, electric vehicles, this entire context here. And so it's looking at the questionnaires at a reason to go, okay, we need to protect European industry because they're not competing well enough. As a point in that, the Volkswagen Group recently is reported to be delaying the release of its cheap city electric vehicle from 2026 to 2027 as a means to, well, and this is as a result of shifting back the Euro 7 timeline, or not the timeline, sorry, the stringency of the rules and the severity of them has been reduced over the last month or two. And now, if only Volkswagen said, okay, we have a bit more leeway, we can wait longer to produce this vehicle and maybe make it a bit better and more competitive, you'd hope. But most importantly, we can sell internal combustion engine vehicles for longer and hybrids and such. Now, I do not see this as a good move if the EV probe doesn't come up with anything. Because Chinese companies like BYD and like Geely in particular are competing incredibly, incredibly competitively with the best of the best in Europe. They are the best vehicle with regards to product versus price as of right now. Now, that's from a consumer perspective. There is also the problem of what do the manufacturers do? Because European OEMs are going to get, frankly, run out of the gates when it comes to the quality of their products. They just don't have the lineup right now relative to China that's been doing this for the past, probably, at least the past 10 years and have been improving with every iteration. They used to be awful, admittedly, but companies are still thinking of Chinese vehicles as, oh, it's just a bunch of Chinese tat that isn't going to last up to traditional German manufacturing. That's what Americans thought about the Japanese. That's what the Europeans thought about the Americans. That's not how this works. You need to take the new country seriously when they have a lower cost of manufacturing and they have more experience in you when it comes to battery design and electric vehicle design. There's a lot of complacency from the industry as of right now. And also quite importantly is that if Europe does decide to introduce tariffs, we saw with the Inflation Reduction Act that China became even more combative when it came to raw material supply restrictions, intellectual property restrictions, the use of different technologies to make key technologies in the West to be able to function within a competitive industry. Now, Europe likes to just introduce tariffs, well, Europe and North America in particular, like to just introduce tariffs on products produced within a region. China likes to introduce tariffs on components that it controls the supply chains of, whether that's rare earth metals, electric drivetrains, gallium and germanium, as used in the semiconductor industry recently, natural graphite. The list goes on and on and on because China had the wherewithal to develop the supply chains for these industries, even when it wasn't a particularly lucrative industry to be in, with all the problems that it has with regards to mining and raw material processing. And it's a very dirty industry. The carbon intensity is very, very high, and it becoming the factory of the world means that it controls the components that go into the factory of the world. And so it has that push to be able to really, really hurt anybody who does it wrong. It's a question for the people studying geopolitics and the side of what is the severity of the retaliation here. Because Chinese companies have already invested significantly in European and adjacent to European manufacturing. China is part of what is a significant part of the reason why Morocco in the north of Africa is quickly becoming an electric vehicle hub. I believe BYD was looking at something there. I know Goshen Hi-Tech was looking at a 100 gigawatt hour LMFP battery factory there.
So this
and is increasing the mining from the industry. It's a very important thing with a lot of facets that we try to explain more in.
So this is something that we see not just with electric vehicles, but we see this trend spurring the electrolysis industry, even the solar industry, where Europe is trying to protect its domestic manufacturing. In your opinion, who is responsible for taking the decision and taking the step to fully fence off any Chinese manufacturing from either earning a slice of the market or benefiting from subsidies?
Well, it's on the European Commission. Effectively, that's the governing body here where it comes to, it has control over the vast majority of the market. Not the UK now, interestingly, so that's not as much of a concern for Chinese competitors, which is partly why we're already seeing Chinese vehicles here when it comes to company car stuff. I know Octopus has some pretty significant integration with BYD as of right now and increasing in the future. But yeah, it's on the European Commission, and the European Commission is quite heavily influenced by what the automotive industry wants. So I think even if they don't find anything, I'm not putting it past them to put some form of protectionism in front of particularly the German automotive lobby. But just, it's a balance of risk. If the European Commission effectively decides that Chinese industry is too much of a danger for European industry to compete with, because frankly they've been asleep at the wheel and continue to be asleep at the wheel in terms of developing market share in the region and developing a competitive product as a result of said market share. Or they decide, no, we don't have the basis for this, or the response will be too great, then Chinese companies will just compete in Europe at a rate where European competitors can't compete. And it will mean the likes of Volkswagen Group, Stellantis, European operations will struggle immensely to maintain the market share that they have in this industry, as happened when it came to American auto manufacturers when Japan was the manufacturer, when Japan was the world's factory post-World War II. It's not a black and white decision. There's a balance here, and part of it is just based on what is China's response going to be, because they still have more elements of the supply chain that they can tighten restrictions on or introduce new ones. So that needs to be taken into account when a choice is made here, because we've seen in the past that China is quite retaliatory when it comes to restrictions being placed on their products, which I don't entirely blame them. When it comes to America, it's because we don't like you because of Taiwan and because we can't compete with you. So 27% tariffs on EVs, just flat out. That's basically their reasoning.
Do you think it's strange that it's taking Europe so long? Because the Inflation Reduction Act, when was that brought into force? Was it a year ago, maybe more than a year?
It's a little bit more than a year ago.
So you've got the US doing that. You've got China, of course, has all kinds of protectionist...
Well, we always know that Europe's a bit slower.
Yeah, is it just because it's
reacting?
Is it just because it's a there's no single president with Build Back Better in his campaign slogan?
Yes, that is part of it. It's also because Europe is slower, but also there's conflicting interests in Europe.
Yeah.
So Hungary and Poland, Eastern Europe, is slowly aligning itself quite a lot with China in that it's taking a lot of investment from them.
Oh, yes. So for Poland and Hungary, when they think about Polish and Hungarian manufacturing, that's actually in alliance
Chinese
with China.
Say, oh, yeah, please do. Yeah, because a lot of the European manufacturing funds are going to Sweden, to Germany. Some of it's going to Poland and Hungary, but it's more split. Whereas Chinese manufacturing is quite heavily in Eastern Europe because their labor costs are lower. And they decide, we'll develop some renewable energy products as well to make it so that it's low carbon and competing well within within the green credentials of the industry. And that's just like, that's even more investment for Eastern Europe than it wouldn't be seeing under the European schemes. So there's conflicting interest between different blocks. And so Hungary, I know, is very, very interested in Chinese money, because I went to an event there ran by a Chinese company, and they had significant ministers over there talking with companies and saying, we can do this. And following that event, I don't know if it was a 100 gigawatt-hour factory or not, but it's going to be CATL's first significant, as it were, European battery factory announcement. It has CATT in Germany, but that's only 30 gigawatt-hours or so. And this is going to be its major, major manufacturing outlet for the European market. And that scares German largely German, but that scares anybody currently manufacturing in Europe that produces internal combustion engine vehicles, because they've not been focusing on the electric vehicle market. And the ones that have are owned by Chinese companies. So we see Volvo shifting to fully electric lineup by 2030. That's owned by Geely Holdings. You see the, I believe it's a London taxi company in England, owned by the same company. It's a major disparity in who is far ahead with making new products, making good products for this industry, and who is still stuck relying on protectionism or effectively saying we need more time, because they only started a few years ago, at least starting in earnest a few years ago.
So you think,
I don't see how Europe can compete.
Do you think the Eastern Europeans have like done the right thing for themselves?
For themselves, yes. It's about whether or not becoming reliant on China immediately after becoming reliant on Russia kind of came to a head is actually taken seriously.
I'm tempted to say the whole situation makes me think of Europe as being defenseless. And when I say that word, I don't want to get too political, but I think of Nord Stream getting blown up and no conclusion as to who actually did it. No one gets caught and it just happens.
I think that's less so being defenseless and more just the consequences of seeing who it was a little bit too great.
And a 10% of Germany's heavy industry being shut down. I think it's at that stage now. And they're still considering the response.
Exactly, yeah. That's another reason why it takes so long. The impact of the CB probe is incredibly far-reaching. It affects consumers significantly, it affects OEMs, it affects the upstream, it affects the entire industry supply chain because it determines whether or not Europe can import Chinese vehicles or Chinese batteries for that matter, which will be significantly cheaper than European batteries because they don't care as much about the environmental regulations. They have the supply chains in place, they've been doing it for a long time, they're not relying on startups to be able to hit the ground running and produce significant amounts of batteries like Europe is with the likes of Northvolt or PowerCo or the various other smaller startups, Talvolt. Like, it has the incumbency here. China has the incumbency here, and it has the long-term cost reductions based on being China. Europe doesn't have that. It is inherently more expensive, and it's more expensive because it's been slow to the mark. It's like, this is going to be a awful analogy, but it's like giving the less athletic man in a race a handicap. Like, you've shot him with the starting gun and expecting him to keep pace with the actual athlete.
Like, let's suppose that China was not directly subsidizing its EV industry. There would still be the inbuilt advantage that electricity prices are lower. And the reason electricity prices are lower are because the entire framework of how it is done is totally different.
Yeah, exactly. But also just electricity, labor, logistics, supply chain, all of these things work in China's favor as of right now and will continue to in the future. Europe doesn't have a way to compete with that outside of protectionism, which is where the carbon border adjustment mechanism comes in. But then Chinese companies invest in the green infrastructure necessary to fudge the accounting in such a way that they're now a green company and aren't affected by CBAM. What does Europe do then? They say, you're still duly supporting your industry, we're going to slap some tariffs on you. And then the supply chain gets messed about with because China restricts some obscure processing technology that's integral to the production of certain components, further raising prices for European consumers. So yeah, not brilliant for Europe in our view as of right now. Moving on, Bogdan. So this company called Frontline is purchasing tankers. The right ones, but not the right ones?
Yeah, it's a bit confusing. They seem like the right ones on the surface, but if you dig into them, they're not quite right. And this is really a highlight of the wider maritime sector, which really loves to take really small steps, baby steps, towards apparent decarbonization in order to keep things running pretty much the same as they used to, business as usual. But we know that that's not the way to go with any industry that's looking to transition to a carbon-free future. So essentially the story is that Frontline, which is a major Norwegian tanker operator, so tankers are ships that transport petroleum and oil from A to B overseas. And obviously until now, tankers burn bunker fuel, a very bad refined form of oil which emits a lot of carbon. Essentially what they've done is they've started selling their old, they're called very large crude carriers, VLCCs. They started selling their old ones in order to buy new eco VLCCs. And then if you dig into these eco VLCCs and what they actually do is they're just to be more energy efficient, they're kind of like latest generation engines in there, cutting fuel consumption maybe by up to 10% per year. So yeah, there's a reduction in emissions, but nothing significant, and obviously nothing with potential for full decarbonization. Another interesting thing to point from the story is that Frontline actually wanted to purchase a stake into Euronav, which is another tank operator, but then that didn't go through because there were some conflicts with the owners and everything. So essentially the resolution of that was that Frontline paid Euronav about $2.25 billion to purchase, I think it was 24 of those Echo VLCCs from Euronav. And interestingly enough, Euronav then spent about half of that money to purchase 120 zero carbon tankers, so about 60 hydrogen combustion and about 60 ammonia combustion carriers. So really a prime example of how to make a poor investment and how to make a good investment all with the same money, essentially.
So when these companies invest in something that is sort of half clean, it's better than it was but not good enough, and then it's, like you say in the article, it's capital intensive, so they want to run it for a very long time to get the benefit, and they don't want to upgrade again until they really have to. When will they actually be forced to upgrade? Will it be Europe at the border?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're looking at the Europe carbon, various carbon taxes that will tighten the reins on the maritime sector. So anything that will, come into Europe via ships, and if the ship is burning carbon intensive fuels, they'll have to then pay a tax. So then this kind of like period of return on those intensive capital investments will forever enlarge. But essentially the current governing bodies and associations that govern the maritime sector, they're putting in very, very small targets, which are easily achievable. But what companies like Frontline fail to appreciate at this point in time is that those will eventually have to change and get tighter. So then if you make a capital investment today and you expect to run those ships for the next 15 years and make a return on them only in this period of time, there you're kind of, you know, bracing yourself for a big surprise when those strings will be tightened and then emissions will need to drop further, and then your 10% fuel improvement is no longer enough to bring.
So you think they'd be better off buying something very green,
more expensive now, makes it a slightly smaller return but has a longer time. How I see this is that companies are buying this middle option because they have some kind of assurance from the relevant environmental organizations in that these will still be vulnerable for X length of time, say 70-80% of their expected lifespan. Because if everybody's doing this, the European Commission can't then just say, oh, and just turn away any ships that don't meet their environmental targets, because then they won't have any ships coming in to transport goods, and that creates problems for the European Union.
Yeah, so the lifetime of such tankers is, it can be even up to 20 years, maybe even more.
So you're expecting 15 to 20, that sort of thing.
Yeah, around 20 years, sure. I think, if I remember correctly, there was a study that's been conducted, and it would only take about 7 years to recover the capital investment on cargo ships. I don't know if tankers have different figure in that category, but I don't suppose it's too different. So you do recover it relatively quickly to the full lifetime rather of the ship. But yeah, essentially, to Andreas's point, it would be more it would be a smarter decision today to invest in full green technology, even though it's a bit more expensive, right? So the capital investments even bigger, but then you will actually be able to run it for the next 25 years until 2050 and make your money back. Because in this current scenario, what companies like Frontline will have to deal with is that they buy a ship that's not green at all. There's just, they have improvements in fuel efficiency, so their emissions will drop, but in maybe 10 years time they'll have to make another capital investment, which obviously will skew the equation and bring their margin out.
It is entirely just a game of how quickly are these emissions going to tighten, and is that profit return period going to be infringed upon for incumbents, as it were.
And can you buy a really clean one and then bombard the European Commission with petitions to up the restriction, you know, to screw all of your rivals over?
Yeah. That would be quite an interesting development, but I think the European Commission might slightly cotton on to that if they were so inclined. Oh, suddenly this company that bought a load of green freight ships is lobbying heavily for improvements in environmental standards.
I thought it always works here. That way, though. Anyway.
It does, and it would be good for consumers, but it's a game of proportions and power. We'd need to take a bit of a closer look at the competitive landscape to see who could feasibly do that. It doesn't sound like a bad idea. It sounds like an interesting little experiment anyways. All of these stories are based on articles we've written for this week's issue. You can find that at rethinkresearch.biz, that's .biz. With more stories to come, we do free each and a supply chain piece each week. So more interesting stories there for you to read. You'll have to talk to Roz about a subscription, but that's easy enough. All right, so moving on to some of the smaller items from this week's issue. So an interesting one here is that Northvolt, as I mentioned earlier, received $5 billion to expand an existing facility and put in place a recycling plant. Northvolt is very much spearheading the European battery manufacturing industry when it comes to companies based in Europe, producing in Europe, and producing elsewhere as well. They were looking at North America before the aforementioned subsidy. It's not particularly good that Europe is becoming increasingly reliant on individual players. It is from a cost point of view until it isn't, because the market is very much going to turn into an oligopoly anyway, as a couple more companies become established, likely PowerCo and a few others that have been heavily supportive by the incumbent automotive OEMs. Also companies that are coming in from China, depending on the results of the EV probe. But it's received $5 billion in financing. It's received $1 billion in straight subsidies to continue operations in its plant in Germany. I forget the exact total, but Northvolt has received over $20 billion in financing so far for the developments of its projects, making it a pretty serious competitor relative to other smaller players within the industry. That's the main point. Europe is becoming more reliant on individual players, which is slightly risky, but will be good for cost in the short to medium term. We are slightly overrunning, so I hope you don't mind, but we're going to end it here. I would like to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you tune in again next week. So that's goodbye from us. Until next time.